We're here this morning on Appeal 03-1384, T.C. Kanan versus Cecil Davis and Mr. Kreider. Good morning.
May it please the Court. The District Court improperly granted habeas relief by overlooking procedural problems and reaching incorrect merits determinations. The Court granted relief on two issues that we are challenging. First is ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to advise the petitioner of his right to testify, and the second is due process violation based on the attempted criminal deviant conduct instruction. With respect to the first issue, we believe it is an open question as to whether the right to testify extends into the sentencing proceeding, as there's no United States Supreme Court decision that is explicitly so held.
But even do you think there are any situations in which it would constitute ineffective assistance of counsel for a lawyer to fail to inform or perhaps remind a defendant of his right to testify at the penalty phase of the trial?
No, Your Honor. That's based on the fact that there's a lack of authority by the Supreme Court regarding exactly that matter.
So there would never be any situation, in your view?
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, we're not...
This is a significantly different argument than you made in your brief. And I think we need to be very careful, first of all, to distinguish the things that you've talked about before and those that you haven't. This petitioner in the district court was not saying that his right to testify per se had been infringed. He's instead talking about the lawyer's advice to him, and the third possibility, which has been in and out of this record, would be the lawyer's failure to call him as a witness. But I understand that that's not what's being argued before us here either. In fact, it's only the lawyer telling him that he has the right to testify. And in your brief, the position you took was that the advice given by the lawyers at the beginning of the case, that with respect to the full proceeding, the guilt phase as well as the penalty phase, was enough. And now you're switching ground, I think, rather significantly to say, well, there's any right to testify anyhow, and so if the lawyer didn't tell him about that, the lawyer wasn't telling him about anything important.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, we merely clarifying.
It's not a clarification, in my opinion.
I thought you were just answering a question rather than enunciating a new theory. But if I understand you correctly, that what your position is that having once made that decision, he doesn't have to, as a matter of competence of lawyer, reiterate the right to testify.
That's correct, Your Honor. The right.
So you're not saying that there's no right to be advised about your right to testify at the penalty phase. You're saying that, in your view, this record shows that that advice was given?
It's twofold, Your Honor. One, it's not clear that there is a right at the sentencing phase, but assuming that there is,
which is something that's not briefed at all in this case. There's not a single sentence in this case about whether the Supreme Court has or has not recognized a right of a capital.
That's correct, Your Honor, although we did argue that there's no authority that a separate advice needs to be given.
Right, I think maybe you should stick with that argument then, because that at least is presented before
us.
Certainly,
Your Honor. There's no merit to this argument that he was not advised, because the state court finding that he was advised of his right is fairly supported by the record.
But
essentially
the state court was willing to rest on the testimony that in the lawyer's mind they thought they were talking to him about the full trial. There's never any finding in the state court that's particularized to the penalty phase.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I believe in part this is due to the nature, the manner in which petitioner raised his claim in the trial court. He didn't claim that he was not advised at the trial court. He He claimed that he wanted to testify at the penalty phase, was advised of that fact, but counsel did not call him.
But
on appeal,
you
he
did
that.
Not, in your brief before the Indiana Supreme Court in the post-conviction phase, which as I understand is the first time he really focused on this failure of advice point that we're now talking about, the state did not say it's too late to raise that. I've looked very carefully at all of the submissions from the state, and the state did not complain about that. Nor did the state complain about that, sort of the timing of this point, in the brief before the district court here, nor did the state say that there was default in these briefs. And so it seems to me you had three chances and you didn't raise that. And we do have a doctrine in this circuit of waiving a waiver, and I'm concerned that perhaps that's what you may have done.
That may be
you may win anyway. You may win on the record. You may win because there's no right. I mean, I'm not saying that in the end of the day this is dispositive, but it seems that the point is here.
Well, I guess I should explain. My point is not necessarily that this is just a waiver, but that circumstance coupled with the facts leads to a conclusion or an inference that he was advised of the right to testify.
When you say that circumstance, which circumstance do you mean?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the way he framed his claim in the trial court.
Okay.
That he stated he was advised for the penalty phase, but he just wasn't called.
What are you specifically referring to when you say that?
Petitioner's briefs in the trial court, particularly we noted in our brief before this court, his proposed findings of fact to the trial court, the state trial court.
Right, but that finding of fact that you highlight is ambiguous at best, in that all it says is, quote, petitioner was told by trial counsel that he should not testify at either part of the trial and that he would not be called as a witness. That's fully consistent with the idea that the lawyers vaguely said at the very beginning of the proceeding, I don't think you should testify, and didn't say anything at the penalty phase. I you know, it's just hard to get much out of that. And you, I also want to wonder if we could look at what you put in your brief at pages 16 and 17. That's Ms. Harris's testimony, where she rather clearly says there was no separate discussion of the penalty phase, at which point, of course, things are quite different. He's been found guilty and the habitual offender hearing has happened.
That's correct, Your Honor. She did testify that there was not a separate advisement at the time of each phase. But she did testify that when they were discussing with him his right, they meant all the phases of this trial.
She said they were talking about it. They were thinking it. But did she ever say, we said to him? She said, here's the question at the top of 17. Did you ever ask Keith if he wanted to testify at the death penalty portion? Answer, I don't think we asked him if he wanted to testify at the death penalty phase. I think we did ask him if he wanted to testify during the trial. That's what the record seems to show.
That's correct, Your Honor. That requires of the determination that what the counsel meant by trial was limited only to guilt phase.
Right.
We
so
believe that trial
the testimony
is,
that they didn't ask him anything about the penalty phase. That's what this record.
That's correct. They did not separately.
Your proposition was that the trial is a single entity from both the guilt phase and the penalty phase.
That is exactly correct, Your Honor. And that
but why did she distinguish between the two then? If she is distinguishing between the two, do you think that's what she meant in her sentence?
My understanding of the record is she was distinguishing between the two in response to a question as to whether there was
right. And
a
so
direct
she says it was
separate
not
advisor.
Discussed separately, even if, you know, now that we're all here with plenty of time, maybe in some conceptual sense there's only one trial, but on the other hand, in death cases, the Supreme Court has repeatedly noted that the death penalty section of capital trial has its own procedural requirements.
Correct, Your Honor. Respectfully, we believe that the facts show that he was testified of his right to trial. Now, granted, there may not have been a separate advisement at each stage, but we believe that there was a one right for the whole proceeding. But even
and no circumstances could change. Not after the jury already knows all about his past offenses, after the habitual offender phase, after the jury has come to the conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed this murder, that lawyers can just sit there mute and not say a word to their client about the penalty phase. Is that consistent with what the Supreme Court was talking about even in Wiggins against Smith?
I believe, Your Honor, in Wiggins versus Smith, they were discussing the failure to present mitigation.
Right. But that's when do you submit mitigation evidence? At which part of the trial?
Well, in Indiana, there are actually two times you can submit it. One at the sentencing proceeding before the jury, and the second time you can present additional circumstances at the sentencing before the judge.
Not during the guilt phase, right? You wouldn't be in there putting your mitigation evidence in.
Well, you could, Your Honor. You could begin
and,
to
but
put
But is that what the Supreme
mitigation.
Court was doing in Wiggins?
I don't recall, Your Honor.
No. It was certainly the sentencing portion that they're dealing with in Wiggins.
That Your Honor's recollection is probably more.
I have it right.
Respectfully, even if there was a failure, we don't believe that he can show a likelihood of a different result in this case. The jury didn't get to hear his testimony. We do not believe that would have changed the decision of the judge to impose a different sentence for three reasons.
Forgive me, you say this case, but you've already stated that you don't think there are any situations in which it would constitute ineffective assistance of counsel to fail to inform about the right to testify at the penalty phase. So it wouldn't just be this case, would it?
No, Your Honor, and that's premised on our belief that there's no authority for the separate phases. But assuming that there should be, we don't believe he can show prejudice in this case. The first of the reason is because the jury's opinion about sentencing was a recommendation. The trial judge was not bound by that. It merely had to give it due consideration along with all the other factors.
But of course, Indiana frequently argues that these recommendations by sentencing juries are indeed a serious and important part of the proceeding. The trial judge is not entitled to utterly disregard it or think that it's frivolous or...
That's correct, Your Honor. It is one factor that the trial court must consider.
And the state of Indiana has frequently argued to us it's an important factor.
Correct, Your Honor. But so it's only one of...
I understand that, but what about going back once again to Wiggins? The type of evidence that Mr. Kanan would have presented is quite similar to the type of evidence that the Supreme Court says there was a reasonable probability it would have affected the result there. Again, it's a kind of drug addiction, you know, abuse, all of the things that... in other words, nobody was saying in Wiggins that the man had saved somebody's life or that he was... In any other way, you know, a worthy person. It's just that it was evidence about his terrible background, which is exactly what we have here, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. But we do not believe that the jury even the judge would have reached a different result.
But how do you know under this reasonable probability standard?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
Well, as the Supreme Court says, we further find that had the jury been confronted with this considerable mitigating evidence, there is a reasonable probability that it would have returned with a different sentence. And, you know, it talks about the totality of the evidence. You don't have to find by a preponderance. It's just a reasonable probability.
Correct, Your Honor. But we do not believe that this evidence would have changed the jury's decision. In fact, in an issue regarding the failure to present mitigation, the district court concluded that the state court's determination that his trial counsel's failure to present mitigation, which included these circumstances of his background, his troubled youth, his drug use. But the state courts got it right, but they weren't unreasonable in that. And this is the same
well,
type
I wouldn't
of information.
Say that the state courts got it right. He found that the state courts weren't so completely insane as to be unreasonable.
Correct, but Petitioner did not show prejudice by the failure to present these circumstances. And these are the same circumstances that he himself would have presented on his troubled childhood and his drug problems in the past.
But that's why the question whether taking this decision away from him is so important, whether, you know, focusing on the failure of the advice. It was his risk to run, wasn't it, that the jury sometimes find these things aggravating. You know, they think, you know, you're completely beyond redemption.
Yes, Your Honor, and we believe that in this case they would have had that sort of effect, given his cold-natured demeanor, his affect.
But why isn't it his choice? Since there was zero mitigating evidence before the jury, as the district court commented, zero.
Plus, the only thing we have to go on here are the two attorneys who are being accused of ineffective assistance stating that he had this cold demeanor. We don't have anything else, do we?
No, we do not, but we do not have a challenge or an assertion that was not the case.
That he was a warm, cuddly fellow, and they could have put him out and made him out to be a nice fellow.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in addition, had he taken the stand and testified, evidence of his priors would have been used against.
Which,
not
of
just
course, the jury already knew
already
all
did.
About.
Yeah.
Because
they
had been through the habitual offender hearing.
That's correct, Your Honor. They did learn of the fact that he had prior convictions. They did not hear of the circumstances surrounding those, which revealed that this was not a nice guy. This was an individual that committed these various crimes, had attempted escape by.
They knew that. They knew all of that. I mean, surely the sting was taken out of a lot of that, and notwithstanding that, to take away from him the choice, you know, I can see before the cat's out of the bag, you might have a very important strategic issue, but given that they went ahead with that habitual offender hearing, it's a different case.
It is a different case, Your Honor, but we believe that had they been brought up again, more information regarding those convictions would have come out, not just the fact that he was convicted of prior burglaries and an escape in a confinement, but the circumstances surrounding those crimes.
You will, I expect, be willing to concede that it is all conjecture, though. Anything that, you know, can be argued at this point is conjecture about what a jury might have, would have, could have believed.
Certainly, Your Honor. There is some inferences and speculation, but because of that, we do not believe that he can show a reasonable probability of a different result, because there's overwhelming circumstances that the trial judge would not have imposed a different sentence. This is a very heinous crime that was committed. It involved...
But why should the conjecture tip to your side?
But particularly if there were other mitigating evidence in the record, then maybe you could be making an argument that adding this is not sufficiently likely to make a difference. But when there isn't any, and this is all there is, and it's the type of evidence that the Supreme Court very recently recognized as pertinent, why isn't some better than none?
Some is certainly greater than none, Your Honor.
Assuming this is evidence that mitigates against the death penalty.
But
the evidence of the fact that he was a complete... the Supreme Court's position, I think, left out one thing, the evaluation that juries might just decide you're irredeemable in its entirety. If the Supreme Court case is completely tied counsel's hands and requires that he put the defendant on the stand and not say all that, might that not be considered the incompetence of counsel?
Correct, Your Honor. We don't believe that they've tied counsel's hands in that manner. We believe that they require an investigation, and there are risks. And it's
always
part
a
of the factor. Always a risk.
There are certainly risks, but once again, we're focusing on whether he made the choice, and what the Supreme Court says about the type of evidence we have here for Mr. Kanan is petitioner, they're talking about Wiggins, thus has the kind of troubled history we have declared relevant to assessing a defendant's moral culpability. And it's the same kind of abuse and So I'm not sure it's up to us to decide whether this is the type of evidence that could be considered mitigating. Obviously, it would be up to any jury to weigh such evidence, and it doesn't require juries to find anything. But hasn't the Supreme Court told us that this type of evidence is pertinent?
Yes, it is pertinent for consideration. But we don't believe that this would have made a difference. It's inconsistent, we think.
Back to the original one. What would the evidence have shown that wasn't already in the record, besides things that added to the program, that is making them look even worse?
The additional evidence that he wanted to bring in was that he had this troubled youth and upbringing.
That was not in evidence. His troubled youth?
That's correct, other than the fact that he had these priors.
It was not in evidence at all, was it? The abuse of his father, the mother driving him, threatening to kill him, and the spray painting, and the drugs, and all the rest of that. Not at all.
That's correct, Your Honor. But counsel was determined not to be ineffective for not presenting mitigation, which included these things, for not calling petitioner and other witnesses.
But, of course, that's a different issue than what we're talking about now, whether he had the right to make such a decision for himself.
It is a different issue, Your Honor, but we believe it's related on the prejudice component of this issue as far as presenting the mitigation testimony. That mitigation would not have made a difference. The counsel is not ineffective for presenting mitigation. We do not believe that he can show prejudice for not testifying. Respectfully, we do not believe that he's entitled to relief on this issue, but we do not believe that he's entitled to relief on the second issue revolving the attempted criminal deviant conduct instruction. This issue is cognizable only to the extent it involves a due process right for the jury to be instructed on all the elements of the crime. The claim was procedurally defaulted because it was never presented to the state Supreme Court. The last court to meaningfully address this question discussed it under state's fundamental error, which is an adequate independent state law ground, and it's not excused by ineffective assistance of counsel argument because he simply phrase dropped that allegation in his brief to the Supreme Court. But in any event, the claim is without merit.
Well, surely I think you might admit that there was a great deal of ambiguity involved in the proof of the deviant conduct crime. So much ambiguity that two justices of the Indiana Supreme Court thought that the evidence of an attempt, to penetrate was insufficient to support a conviction. I mean, isn't this just the type of case that ought to require a jury to find proof beyond a reasonable doubt on a specific intent issue?
Your Honor, the judge disagreed as to the sufficiency of the evidence. That's the question of whether the jury was apprised of the elements for attempted CDC. They were under state law. The jury was instructed on a definition of criminal deviant conduct, instructed that deviant sexual conduct included the penetration of a sex organ by an object.
I have a more fundamental question. Why did the prosecution want to put that in anyway?
I have no idea.
The evidence in the case showed the murder beyond any question of doubt, and even the trial judge in our instant case wound up tearing his head off in his opinion. But why bother putting in, why over-try the case? Why accuse him of things, whether true or not, that leave the door open for this sort of thing?
Your Honor, I'm only speculating.
I know, you're the poor guy that has to sweep up after the elephants are going by. But doesn't this strike you as being ridiculous to take something where you already won all the case and then decide you're going to throw further manure on it?
It may be, and that's a risk I believe that's taken. However, I think one of the factors in the prosecutor's decision may have been to try or charge petitioner with every crime that he thought he committed.
Well, that's what I think is ridiculous. I mean, the fundamental crime you want to catch him for is murder. And you've got that down cold, and you've got the various stabbings and so on. And then you throw in one that is, you know, I see, you know, why it's there is a fundamental error of judgment. I mean, you could just make a mistake. Why do it?
I can't answer the prosecutor, Your Honor.
I know you can't.
But I
apologize for the question, but
that's perfectly fine, Your Honor.
As a long-time prosecutor, I get nervous about decisions that strike me as being, you know, counterproductive at best. Why leave it room for an argument?
And I have no idea, Your Honor,
I know you don't. I don't. We're all bad.
So how important is this conviction as an aggravating circumstance for the death penalty?
Well, this is only one.
It just goes away. Does it make any difference in your view?
In our view, there is still one remaining aggravator, and the state courts should be allowed to reweigh that aggravator against the mitigation, and that would cure the constitutional problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we would ask that such a remedy be available here.
You're running into your rebuttal time. You know.
Yes, Your Honor. With the permission of the court, there's no more questions. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is John Pinnell. I represent the petitioner appellee, Keith Kanan. This court should affirm the decision of the district court for basically three reasons. First of all, the record is very clear that trial counsel did not advise, did not consult with Kanan about his right to testify at the penalty phase.
At the penalty phase. Do you have any case that shows that the failure to tell separately that he has a right to testify constitutes reversible error?
In Strickland, the United States Supreme Court talks about counsel needs to consult with the client about his own decisions.
They only consult with counsel. We've got that. If you have any case that says that at the penalty phase it is necessary that they reiterate their position, they do have a right to testify.
Well, one of the important decisions in a death penalty case is whether or not
I understand that. Let me ask the question one more time. Do you have a case which says that the failure to advise the client that he has the right to testify at the penalty phase, apart from the original, requires finding an incompetence of counsel? Do you have any such case?
There are cases.
Well,
it's a compound response to your question, Your Honor.
Well, I don't want to compound. I don't know if the answer is yes or no. That's not compound. Is there such a case?
There's not a single case.
There's not a single case.
There's a group of cases.
So if we do this, we will establish for the first time such a single case.
No, Your Honor, because petitioner had the right to present mitigation evidence.
He does.
At the penalty phase.
There's no question.
Lockett and Eddy.
No question about it.
He had the right to testify.
He does.
If he had the right to present mitigation and he had the right to testify,
yes,
he certainly would have, and if he has got the right to be advised by counsel.
But he was advised by counsel at the beginning. We've already established that. We're not going to put him on the stand.
For the trial phase.
Well,
the guilt phase.
If he's for the trial.
Well, the guilt phase, Your Honor.
But it's part of the trial.
It's part of the trial. In this case,
so it's just part of the trial. The whole thing is a trial.
Yes.
So, I don't know. I'm not quarreling with the fact that we may do this. I'm just saying this will create the first time somebody has said explicitly, if they decided to put him on at the guilt stage, when we get to the stage where we're going to decide what we're going to do, we have to really tell him you have a right to testify.
We're not requesting a new role. We're saying Strickland applies in
counsel. Does Strickland say that you have a right to be given advice of counsel at all stages?
Every stage.
Every stage of the trial. Circumstances.
Every important decision. Every important decision. Well, in this case, the penalty phase is a very important decision.
Well, every time, though, we're talking about any phases in the game, that's just one of them.
Doesn't it depend on the circumstances of the particular stage and the particular decision? Such that, I mean, I'm not aware of the Supreme Court ever saying that there's a script for the lawyer at any point, beginning to end. But what they have said, from Strickland on through Wiggins, is that every stage, you need whatever the circumstances require.
That's right.
But I wonder, you can do this in any order, but I really basically have three questions for you. One of them has to do with the very late in the day appearance of this argument on behalf of Mr. Kanin at the Indiana Supreme Court in the post-conviction proceedings, where it's the first time I can find that anybody focuses on the failure to advise Mr. Kanin at the penalty phase of this. As Judge Bauer says, maybe this right, maybe not this right. But anyway, that's the first time that argument comes up. So that's point one. Point two is the fact that, as your opponent has argued, as the district court reviews the very evidence, the mitigating evidence from the point of view of counsel, it says, well, you know, we can't say that the state courts unreasonably resolved the question about whether this drug use and everything else would have made a difference. Why should it, in fact, be different when we're looking at his right to testify? And my third question really is in terms of your second argument. Indiana, I think, could have defined whatever attempt offense it wanted. It could have defined an attempt offense that focused on knowingness. It could have done specific intent. Why, at the end of the day, is it a federal problem, even putting to one side the very obscure way that the federal dimension of this comes up, if Indiana has chosen an attempted criminal deviant conduct offense that rests on knowingness? So those are the three things that I would love you at some point in your argument to address.
I think I'll just go ahead and address your questions one by one, Your Honor. The first question is why the late raising of the claim. The claim was pled as failure to call Kanin as a witness at the penalty phase. The reason he wasn't called as a witness at the penalty phase is, quite frankly, his attorneys never even discussed it with him. And that issue was resolved by the post-conviction trial court on the merits.
I couldn't find anything that actually alerts the post-conviction trial court to the fact that it's deciding this advice issue as opposed to the calling of him. I know it's a fine distinction, but I think it is a distinction.
The trial court was alerted because most of the testimony at the post-conviction hearing by the attorneys was precisely on the point of, did you even discuss with him the right to testify at the penalty phase? I mean, quite frankly, the issue was tried by the consent of the parties in this case. The state did not object, and both parties asked questions to the attorneys back and forth. Did you discuss with him at this stage, that stage? And it was tried by the consent of the parties, and that's why there is a finding by the trial court in this case on that issue. Kanin then raised the issue to the Indiana Supreme Court explicitly in his brief. The state never, in the state court, responded with waiver at that point. They could have. They did not. And if they've got a waiver application, we don't think they do, they waived it. The answer to your second question is, the reason it makes a difference on the mitigation is because all that Kanin had at the penalty phase was potentially his testimony. The jury had seen all the evidence in this case, and this is a fairly brutal murder. They've already heard he's a habitual offender. They know about his prior criminal record. They surely concluded he's a cold-blooded killer. There has to be something in the penalty phase for the defense to give the jury a reason to show some mercy. The only way that's going to exist in this case, given the lack of other available mitigation at the penalty, was Kanin's testimony. It would have humanized him before the jury. They would have seen Kanin and possibly have seen a shred of humanity that would have justified not imposing the death sentence in this case.
You know, there's a passing reference in your brief that Mr. Kanin was borderline mentally retarded. Is there evidence as to this fact in the record?
I think there may have been a reference to borderline mentally retarded in the context of the case of Williams versus Taylor. There's three different circumstances in Williams versus Taylor. One is...
No, I understand all of this. What I'm wondering is, in this record...
No.
There's no evidence at all?
No, there's no evidence that he's borderline mentally retarded.
Okay, even the doctor who testified, nothing?
No. I think the IQ tests were in the 80s, is my recollection.
But that's not in the record?
It's part of the mitigation. It's not really part of the issue before this court because that issue wasn't presented on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
But no, there's no evidence in the record that he was borderline mentally retarded.
Okay.
I think there may have been something in the brief about borderline mentally retarded, but what strikes me is that was one of the factors in Williams versus Taylor. You know, there are two other factors in Williams versus Taylor that make it like this case, which is the deprived background, you know, basically a horrible childhood, and a spur-of-the-moment killing. It was not a planned-out, thought-out, premeditated, and advanced killing.
But I guess what the state has argued is, even in the situation you describe, where there's, of course, ample aggravating circumstances, the nature of this particular murder is truly awful, and the jury already knows about the priors, the habituals, if Mr. Kanan had gotten up and had testified about his background, why aren't we entitled to say that if that wouldn't have made any difference from the point of view of counsel putting it on, why would it have made any difference? Why is it anything from the point of view of the prejudice side of the Strickland analysis? Because of course, if there's no prejudice, then there's no ineffective assistance.
Well, the other factor in this case is it humanizes them, and also the way that Indiana weighs aggravators against mitigators. In this case, the state basically had two aggravators. There was no mitigation evidence, as found by both the district court and actually the trial court that sentenced Kanan. If Kanan testified, he's got the opportunity to present some mitigating circumstances in this case. And there's a reasonable probability that there's a different result.
Under your theory, if the lawyers for the defendant had reviewed the right to testify with them and said, in our opinion, if you testify, you'll hurt yourself, have they sufficiently passed the competence rule?
The lawyer's duty is to advise
the lawyers say to them, you have a right to testify, but in our opinion, you shouldn't do it because you're a cold personality and you'll be subject to even further cross-examination. Would that be sufficient to uphold the competency thing?
He's still the one who has to make the decision.
Yes, but he says, okay, I'll go along with the program. Can he later say that as a result of that advice, I didn't testify and I should have?
No, because he doesn't have sufficient performance, and it's also basically a classic hindsight under Strickland.
But if the position that the Supreme Court has enunciated that this is evidence that's very pertinent that should go before, then the advice not to put it on should be an incompetent program too, shouldn't it? They'd have to put it on.
I'm sorry.
They'd have to tell them you ought to testify.
They don't have to tell them you ought to testify. They have the right to, they need to advise them the right to testify.
So the advice that is sufficient.
He has to make an informed decision at that point whether or not to testify.
But if they say, in their opinion, you should not do this and this is why, and he doesn't, that should take care of the problem.
That would have taken care of the problem, that's correct. They did not do that, unfortunately. Going back to your question, there was, why does Indiana define attempt the way it defines attempt?
Well, and actually, my real question is, you know, it's not up to us to tell Indiana how to define attempt. And even if the Indiana State Court got the Indiana state law wrong, it's still not a federal problem unless you have this due process dimension, which is barely hinted at. I mean, I found two sentences that mentioned the due process clause of the 14th, or one sentence that mentioned the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, and another sentence that I think alludes more generally to due process. But why? How does this get to be a federal issue?
Okay. The reason it's a federal issue is because a defendant has a due process right to only be convicted if there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt of every element of the offense, and that's in Winship.
Right.
Post-Winship cases apply that to instructional issues. Sandstrom, Mulaney, Francis. You can't, by an instruction, either shift the burden of proof on an element, Mulaney, or presume an element, Sandstrom and Franklin. If you can't do that, you certainly cannot eliminate an element from the instruction.
But what if, I mean, isn't the problem here, what exactly are the elements under Indiana law of this attempted crime? Because Winship is also clear that it's up to the state to define what those elements are.
At the time Cano was tried in November of 1986, there were a couple of crucial cases that had discussed the attempt statute. The primary case was Zickafoos, which happened to be an attempt murder case, and where the Indiana Supreme Court for the first time discussed the attempt statute. And what it basically said is it required specific intent on proof of the intended offense.
It's pretty obvious, isn't it, that Mr. Kanan's attorneys were either not aware or had forgotten Zickafoos, Bradlin, Taylor, Smith.
Both Zickafoos and Smith had been decided by the time of trial, and counsel should well have been aware from those decisions that specific intent to commit the offense of criminal deviant conduct, was an element of the case. And the instructions given by the trial court, the only mens rea that's really discussed goes to the substantial step element, the conduct of stabbing.
What would you say in response to the state's claim that at the time of his crime, the required mens rea for an attempt crime could be either knowing or intentional?
Under Smith, it talks about knowing or intentional. In this case, the knowing or intentional solely goes to the substantial step element of the stabbing. In other words, he must have knowingly or intentionally stabbed the victim. There was no requirement in the instructions that he must have knowingly or intentionally, which, i.e. with specific intent, intended to commit the offense of criminal deviant conduct by stabbing her.
But
that's what's missing from the instruction.
But when you combine instruction 29 with the actual instruction, because this jury was instructed as well on the offense, criminal deviant conduct, instruction 23 and some of the others, when you combine those, taken as a whole, which is the way we're supposed to do this, why isn't it clear to this jury that it's the commission of that crime, a substantial step toward doing this thing? The jury understands what the step has to be for, and it's got to be intentionally to commit this crime.
The jury is instructed on the crime, which the charged crime was actual criminal deviant conduct.
Right, that's right. And there's a whole instruction on what that means. And
they're given the statutory definition of attempt. The problem you get into is none of the instructions, even if you take all the instructions together, none of them tell the jury, you must find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Cain, with the specific intent, intended to commit the offense of criminal deviant conduct when he took the substantial step, and then you go on from there. It's not there. I mean, there's a definition of knowingly, there's a definition of the alternative of knowingly. Those are there, but those are also there when they're defining the elements of knowing or intentional substantial step, the conduct. There is not informed of the distinction.
If the jury found that the murder was committed intentionally during the crime of burglary, would it matter whether the attempted criminal deviant conduct instruction was proper? In other words, if the burglary was enough to get Mr. Kanan the death sentence, would the error on the criminal deviant conduct be harmless?
I assume you're setting aside for a moment the other issue.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, because Indiana's a laying state. Then the issue would be, does this case have to be remanded back to the state court to reweigh the valid aggravating circumstance of burglary against all the mitigating circumstances present in the record? The problem you get into...
Well, they couldn't do that. There are no mitigating circumstances.
Everything in the record.
Okay.
I mean, there are things that are now in the record that they should be reweighing.
Yes.
The problem you're going to get into, if you send it back to the Supreme Court and say, you guys goofed, on this attempt criminal deviant conduct aggravator. The burglar is okay. Go ahead and reweigh. The problem is you have had a subsequent legal development, Ring versus Arizona. The jury never actually made a finding that Kanan was guilty of an intentional murder. He was charged with a knowing murder in this case. He was then found guilty of a knowing murder at the guilt phase, found guilty of burglary, attempt criminal deviant conduct. The jury then reached a general verdict, a recommendation, at the penalty phase where they recommended death. There are no specific findings where they say, we find this was an intentional killing in the course of a burglary. We find this was an intentional killing in the course of attempt criminal deviant, that they're not there. Nor is there a finding, which under the NLF required, that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating circumstances. So in our position is, you can't just simply send it back to the Supreme Court. It's ultimately going to have to go back for a new trial on the penalty.
And at such a new penalty proceeding, he presumably could receive the death penalty again.
Yep.
Would it, just out of curiosity, I'm not sure if this is pertinent to anything, so I apologize in advance, but would such a new proceeding, in your view, take place under the amended Indiana statute or under the old statute? Because Indiana has, in fact, of course, changed its proceedings.
Well, I believe the old statute is basically unconstitutional under Ring, because it does not require the jury to make those determinations.
Right, but it, just in terms of retroactivity, maybe, I mean, the old statute was pre-Ring anyway, upheld a number of times, and there are some distinctions between Indiana and Arizona, but just as a matter of normal procedural law, would a new death penalty hearing, do you think, take place under the new statute?
It would be under the new statute, though there are problems with the new statute also.
No, I'm not asking you to concede anything. This is a very
there are
simple
problems.
Question.
There are problems.
Okay.
I mean, that's what happened. I mean, there's been a couple death penalty cases where the offense occurred prior to the new statute being enacted, and that was a real issue. Which do you do it? Which statute do you apply? And one of the state courts applied kind of a combination. In that case, it's probably going to get reversed in the state court.
Mm-hmm.
Another
that's
court
bizarre.
Applied the new statute with some modifications. It's a strange...
Indiana itself hasn't actually resolved this question yet.
No, they have not. There's a case called, I think, Ritchie versus State, which I think has been argued in the Indiana Supreme Court. There's also a case called Stroud versus State, although that will probably be reversed on a guilt phase issue, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me get back to the discussion of the whole idea of whether or not Kanan was advised his right to testify at the penalty phase. If you look at the record in this case...
Well, I think the record is pretty obvious. He was not advised separately of his right to testify.
Okay.
You don't have to convince anybody of that, I know.
What that means, effectively, is the NAS Supreme Court's determination is unreasonable because they're assuming he was advised. He was not.
No, they said he was advised for the entire proceedings, but not separately advised. They didn't suggest that, did they?
The Indiana Supreme Court basically found that he was advised, and they quoted the language.
He was advised at the beginning that there was no place in the record that they could say, here is where he was advised, that he had a separately of his right to testify.
There was no place they could cite to the record. To the
right.
Press. And their determination that it was strategy is simply unreasonable. It can't be strategy if the person who's making the decision, which is Kanan, doesn't even talk with his attorneys about
it. Well, if you accept the fact that the original decision not to testify that he agreed with started from the beginning and finished after the at the time of the sentencing, then they are correct in saying that he was advised that he had a right to testify and decided not to.
I don't agree with that, though, because
you don't have to keep telling him.
Yeah.
If that was that premise, then they're right.
Yeah, but the big circumstance was they had tried the habitual offender phase, and a jury, the two reasons to not call him were his priors. Well, the jury heard about him.
I know what your position is, but I'm just trying to cover the Supreme Court with a modicum of of intelligence by saying if they you take their premise that the original decision lasted right through till he went to the penitentiary, then they're right. But if you take the position that you do, that the reason he didn't testify was because they didn't want all this baloney to go in. It went in anyway, so now there's no reason he should have been re-advised, then your position is correct. But they're not wrong starting with their premise. Just that we think that they, or we would have to say that he was required that he be retold and have a right.
We just don't agree with the premise, basically.
Yeah. Right.
You're inferring from the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion on post-conviction, I mean, this is really a question, when the court refers to a conclusion that it would not be in Kanan's interest for him to testify at the penalty phase, which is what they say, that the court is assuming that there was some discussion focusing on the penalty phase.
Well,
I mean, the court uses the term at the penalty phase.
Yeah. One of the things the Indiana Supreme Court does, and one of the things in their standard of review, is the way they look at a trial court's findings on post-conviction. In this case, the trial court found he was advised of his right to testify at the penalty phase.
Right, and the trial court actually says at the penalty phase.
They
not,
do.
Although,
and they,
as Judge Bauer is pointing out, perhaps they're, I don't know whether they're inferring that from some generic advice, but they actually use the term at the penalty phase.
That's in the trial court findings.
Yeah.
And what the Indiana Supreme Court did is they looked, is there any evidence in the record that supports those findings? And they purported to find such evidence and affirmed.
Well, then they dropped this footnote, too, right?
Which discusses the prejudice.
Yeah. Well, which discusses the colloquy with
right.
counsel about testifying.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. But that's all, I mean, I'm not missing anything. That's all there is to find in the Indiana.
That's all there is. The consequence of the unreasonableness of the Indiana Supreme Court's decision is this case is not reviewed under the AEDPA. It's reviewed as a mixed question of law and fact. And
under 2243 is your argument.
That's correct. And counsel's performance simply, as the district court judge pointed out, is deficient. I mean, you simply have to talk with the client, both as a matter of state law, because he's got a right to testify at the mitigation stage. He's got a state law constitutional right to testify because the Indiana Constitution is a little bit different from the federal Constitution. It talks in terms of, instead of the right to the assistance of counsel, it talks to be heard by himself and counsel. So it's clear he's got a better or a stronger constitutional right to testify than he does under the federal Constitution. Counsel under the Rules of Professional Conduct and the ABA standards certainly would have had a duty to advise Kanan of his right to testify at the penalty stage. He
and
didn't do it.
The Supreme Court looked at those same canons in Wiggins.
They did.
Yeah.
And the other thing about the context of this case is it's very important that they do discuss it with Kanan because they had nothing else. They had no other mitigation evidence. There was zero evidence presented about Kanan's personal history and background at the penalty. The district court found that. The trial court found that. And the consequence is Kanan was prejudiced. I think I've already discussed, you know, why, you know, petitioner believes he's prejudiced. I mean, the case is similar to Williams versus Taylor, and it's also similar to Wiggins. I mean, the personal background is terrible. The other issue on which Kanan believes the district court should be affirmed is the instructional claim. And the district court found that the issue of ineffective assistance to counsel for not objecting to the instruction was fairly presented to the state court. And that issue, indeed, was raised to the Indiana Supreme Court on the post-conviction appeal. It was also raised in a post-hearing memorandum to the trial court, and I'm citing to page 48 of the record of proceedings. So it's clear that the claim was presented. It was not waived. The Indiana Supreme Court did not deal with the issue of ineffective assistance to counsel on the instructional issue at all. They did not discuss it. So we're back in the situation where we are not under the AEDPA. We are under Strickland. It's a mixed question of law and fact. And counsel at the time of trial should have known, pursuant to Zickfuss and Smith, that specific intent to commit the prescribed offense of a premeditated conduct was an element of the offense. And the Indiana Supreme Court, as much as found that specific intent was an element of the offense when they talked about it on the direct appeal. In their direct appeal discussion of sufficiency of the evidence, as well as the separate instructional issue that was raised on direct appeal, they talked about specific intent to commit the prescribed offense as an element of the offense. So it was an element. We disagree with the state in that position. Kanan was prejudiced on that issue for a number of reasons. First, there was a substantial dispute. I see, okay, is that 1 minute?
1 minute.
1 minute. There's a substantial dispute on what offense was being committed when the stabbing occurred. Was he merely out to simply kill the victim? She was stabbed over 20 times. Many of the wounds were in her chest, her arms, her neck. She was stabbed over her body. The testimony of the pathologist indicates this was a rapid killing. The issue was, is this simply a murder, or is it murder and also intent to commit another offense? Well, there's ambiguity there. Defense counsel at the guilt phase argued that ambiguity in his closing argument. Intent was an issue for the jury to decide. So Cain clearly was prejudiced by counsel's failure to object to the deficient instruction. Our last comment I'd like to make would be on the Richardson case cited by the state in its brief, and we believe Richardson is distinguished for a number of reasons. I see the red light is up.
Finish your thought, please.
It's distinguishable for a number of reasons. The instruction in Richardson that the Indiana Supreme Court is dealing with, the mens rea instruction defines the element of conduct. It does not define the element of specific intent to commit, in Richardson, it's battery. And footnote 4, the Indiana Supreme Court noted that that other issue, the one Kanan is now raising, was not raised, was not before. The other reason Richardson is not applicable and doesn't really help the state is the Supreme Court purported to distinguish attempt murder from other attempt crimes based on the severity. Well, here, the severity is even greater because the attempt criminal deviant conduct is an aggravating circumstance for the death penalty. The other reason which they distinguished it was the ambiguity inherent in a lot of attempt murder. Who's he shooting at? Is he shooting at person A, shooting at person B? It's not clear. In this case, there's an ambiguity on whether the stabbing was intended as to commit murder or murder and criminal deviant conduct. There's an ambiguity. So, and the final reason Richardson is distinguishable is the state cannot retroactively change the elements of the offense after the fact as a matter of due process of law. And we cited Marks versus United States and Lee versus City of Columbia at that point. I thank you, and
thank you.
We ask the district court decision to be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Kreider, if you wish, you may have 2 extra minutes. I mean, on top of what you already have saved because of the time given you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be as brief as possible, though. I have a few points I wish to make. First, with respect to the instruction issue, this was a correct instruction under state law. The instructions as a whole fully apprised him of the two elements, that he had the required culpability for the object crime, and that he engaged in conduct that was a substantial step toward that crime. Petitioner relies primarily on a later decision in Spradlin that requires particular language be used in a murder, an attempted murder, to convey these elements. That language is not required with other attempt crimes. Second, regarding the discussion of Ring, whether the prior version or the new version, frankly, I don't know the answer. There are 4 cases I know of that are pending. Ritchie, Stroud, Ward, and McManus, the first 2 have been argued. The latter 2 have been fully briefed and are awaiting argument. How that will come out, I do not know, but Ring has not been applied retroactively. Finally, just with respect to the first issue, there was nothing to alert the trial court that counsel had failed to advise. In fact, the foundation of his claim presupposed that he was advised, but the counsel just failed to call. Whether the state waived that, we may have, but we still believe that that is an assertion or admission on petitioner's part that affects the outcome and reveals that he was advised. If there are no questions, thank the court and would ask that you reverse the district court's grant of relief.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kreider, and thank you very much, Mr. Pino. And the case will be taken under advisement, and thanks to Mr. Schornhorst as well. Court will be in recess until
signing
further notice. Until further notice.